We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us this afternoon. Illinois is a long way from an ocean view, yet here in the Midwest and across the globe, oceanic waters are our life support system. Among other things, they produce most of the oxygen that we breathe. They absorb a significant amount of carbon dioxide emissions. The weather systems that sweep into Illinois from the north, south, and west provide the water that sustains us. Sylvia Earle is our guest this afternoon. She's an oceanographer and National Geographic Explorer in Residence who has led more than 60 expeditions. In a speech she delivered in 2009, she said, "No water, no life, no blue, no green." Sylvia Earle joins us today to talk about the health of our oceans, the health of the planet, and our future. It's the topic of her latest book, The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. The book is published by the National Geographic Society. Sylvia Earle is a former NOAA chief scientist. She's been called her deepness by The New Yorker and The New York Times. Time magazine honored her as its first hero for the planet, while the Library of Congress has named her a living legend. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call or an email message. The phone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, will-talk@illinois.edu. Sylvia Earle, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Great to be on board.
Very early in your book, you say Earth's life support system, the ocean, is failing. How dire is the situation?
Well, there are signs that are obvious everywhere. That is, to see the loss of ocean wildlife. In 50 years, we've managed to extract on the order of 90% of many of the fish that we so love to consume, the tunas, swordfish, sharks, the grouper, the snapper. That in itself is rather shocking. Other matters of concern that relate to climate change, the CO2 in the atmosphere is not just driving the warming trend, which has an effect on the ocean and us, of course, but also sea level rise, which, again, comes right back to us. Mm-hmm. But more troubling, perhaps, than either of these is the acidification of the ocean, something that was not noticed until about 10 years ago. That excess carbon dioxide, that much of it is absorbed and incorporated into ocean systems, but the excess now is turning to carbonic acid, and the trend toward acidification, changing the chemistry of the ocean, is a cause for worry because of its cross-cutting impact on the nature of the oceans as a whole.
Hmm. You know, I think people listening might say, though, but you know how... how worried should we be? Because the ocean is so huge, so vast.
That's exactly what we have thought through most of our history. It's only in the 20th century that, on one hand, we've learned more about the ocean than during all preceding history, but we've also been responsible for greater change than during all preceding history. we did not imagine half a century ago that we could modify the way the world works through temperature changes, through excess carbon dioxide, through what seem to be innocent actions that have unexpected, unintended consequences. Nobody thought that there would be or could be a limit to what we could take out of the ocean or what we could put into the ocean. It's been used as a big garbage heap, a place to put things we did not want close to our to where we live on the land. But now we know, and now that that information is beginning to come into focus, actions are being taken, not just to make the ocean recover and make it a healthier, more stable place, but because it really translates back to things that matter to us. Most importantly, it keeps us alive. I mean, with every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, we're connected to the ocean. It doesn't matter where on the planet we live.
So with a very ailing ocean or no ocean, we wouldn't be here.
Think Mars. Yeah. Think Mars. There it is. A planet much like Earth without an ocean. And apparently Mars did have an ocean. There is some water there. There may be life there. But it's not a hospitable planet for the likes of us. It took 4.5 billion years to get Earth more or less to a place that we now enjoy and take for granted. But if we were able to time travel back to Earth as it was 1 billion years ago, it would not be a very friendly place. The level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would be greater than it is today. Oxygen hadn't reached the level that we now enjoy. It's taken a lot of fine-tuning. And here, without knowing, we have taken actions that have disrupted the way the planet works. We know, for example, through scientific studies that we've greatly created holes in the atmosphere. The ozone layer has been changed owing to what we put into the atmosphere. What we put into the atmosphere has changed the temperature of the planet as a whole and caused other health problems as well. The soot that we breathe from fires that have burned over the ages, all that translates to bad news for us. But the good news is that we know. And it isn't too late to turn things around. But if we continue without taking action, without just slowing down on what we take out of the ocean or what we're putting into the atmosphere, what we're putting into the ocean that has harm, does harm to that which keeps us alive, we'll get eventually to a place where we run out of time. Mm-hmm. There still is time, but we should do everything we can while there still are 10% of the sharks and swordfish and tunas and other creatures left in the sea before they're literally all gone, to reverse the trends in terms of what we are putting into the atmosphere. I mean, we can't pull it back out overnight, but we can certainly change our habits now that we know that they're doing us harm.
Yeah. At a number of points in The World is Blue, you say essentially there is no surplus in natural, healthy systems just waiting for people to exploit. So.
Yeah, that's been the theory, that there's a surplus of fish. We used to think that about wildlife on the land, too. Not so long ago, even a century ago, people were still taking some wildlife from the land in commercial quantities. And going back 2 centuries, that was a major way of providing food for people, but we can't feed our growing numbers with songbirds and little furry things from the land. And now we know we can't take large quantities of wildlife from the sea on a large-scale basis and hope to feed the large numbers of people who need to be fed. We have to look to ways of cultivating the calories that we actually require to live.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the chapter titled Smart Aquaculture.
Mm.
And you quote a fellow ocean scientist, Jeremy Jackson, as saying, to get a lot of protein from the sea in the future, aquaculture is the answer. And then you follow those words with these, but it has to be the right kind of aquaculture. What is the right kind?
Low on the food chain. Mm. We don't raise lions and tigers, eagles and owls to eat. We raise creatures that eat plants, and they grow from the time they start out to the time they can be brought to our table. And, well, the faster the better. For chicken, it's now about 7 months. For some of the mammals that we consume, lamb, pigs, cows, less than a year, or maybe at most 2 years. But a tuna fish takes about 6 years to mature, and they may be 10 or 20 or 25 or 30 years before they're caught. The investment in a pound of tuna versus cows and chickens and things is many times greater. To make a pound of chicken, it's 2 pounds of plants. To make a pound of cow, it's about 15 pounds of plants for 1 pound of beef. But to make a pound of a yearling fish, it's about 600 pounds of plants because of the food chain. Mm. They eat fish that eat fish that eat other fish, and finally you get down to the little plants that are out there in the ocean that are not only driving the food webs in the sea, but they're also generating oxygen. They're driving the carbon cycle and the chemistry of the ocean as a whole. When we extract, as we are, 100 million tons of ocean wildlife every year, it isn't like raising cows and chickens and pigs. We're taking carnivores whose pound-for-pound investment is hundreds of times greater than raising the plant-eating animals that we do and have been doing for more than, thousands of years. We don't raise carnivores for a good reason. It just costs too much. It takes too big a bite out of the surrounding environment. It takes a lot of plants to make grazers. It takes a lot of grazers to make carnivores.
I was, some years ago, I learned from a lobsterman that a legal lobster is at least 7 years old.
Yeah.
And they're on the small side.
Yeah, that's right. And they can be 50 years old if we let them grow and reproduce.
And I was also surprised to read in the book, The World is Blue, that mussels, which I adore, can take 2 to 4 years to reach maturity.
Right. And they're among the better choices in terms of seafood, except for the fact that mussels do a great job of filtering large quantities of material from the sea, which makes them part of the cleanup crew. That means that we get the concentrated dose of what they've been consuming, oysters, clams, whatever. But it's even more so if you think about the top-end carnivores like tunas and sharks and swordfish and cod and rockfish. What is it? Bluefish, orange roughy. These are old fish that have been eating carnivores that eat carnivores, eat carnivores. And the further up the food chain you go, the higher the concentration of things like mercury, fire retardants, the things we've been putting into the ocean, such as the pesticides and herbicides. And yes, we do get benefits from having protein, but we get this other dose of things we don't want in us when we do so. And there are ways to get your omega-3s by sources that are cultivated. You don't have to kill fish to get omega-3 oils that are good for us. In fact, you get a lot of good omega-3s from plants, from nuts and seeds of various sorts. But beyond that, to be able to go to a cultivated source of the plankton that the fish actually require to get their omega-3s, they don't manufacture them. They get them through the food chain, and we can bypass the fish and go straight to the source. I mean, there are a number of companies that are actually growing the plankton. It's like eating celery or tomatoes or any of the other crops that we buy. In this case, it's getting the plankton that provide the omega-3s. Seems like a good idea to me.
Yeah. In terms of the fish, what species are or might be candidates for cultivation that would be that we could do ethically, that we could do sustainably?
Three good choices. One is a fish that in China has been raised for more than 1,000 years, variations on the theme of carp. There's one Asian carp that has now been growing in large numbers in fresh waters in the United States. There's concern because they're displacing. They're so successful. They're plant eaters. I recently saw an article about a chef suggesting that a solution to curtailing their invasion of our fresh water and displacing our native species is to eat them. They're good food, and they're low on the food chain, and they can get to be really substantial chunk of protein. Another is catfish, and I wouldn't suggest eating wild catfish because, again, they can live for quite a long time, and it isn't as good a deal as eating cultivated catfish that are fed food that you can rely on, not getting all the stuff that we've allowed to go into our waters coming back to us in a negative form. So farm-raised catfish, and not imported from half a world away, but from somewhere from U.S. sources, and tilapia, similarly. It's basically an African fish, and it too is successful, so much so that it's been coming into our freshwater systems. But if cultivated tilapia is one of the best choices, very tasty fish, high quality protein, and they go from egg to fish that you can prepare any number of ways in less than a year. It's 2 pounds of plants to about a pound of tilapia, carp, and catfish. Mm. So I appeared on the Colbert Report, and he expressed mock dismay over not being concerned about eating wild fish. He said, "Well, how am I going to get my mercury then?" So you can avoid getting your mercury by choosing catfish, carp, and tilapia and being creative about how they're presented. Think of the hundreds of ways, maybe thousands of ways, that we have creatively presented for consumption chicken, beef, lamb, pork, you know, all of those sources that creative chefs have provided food. But with fish, one of the problems is that we're not discriminating when it comes to fish, really. Mostly we're not. We get a fish sandwich, and it could be any of hundreds of different species, and it tastes like whatever it is that you put on it, lemon or garlic or breadcrumbs, deep fried or whatever. Rarely is a fish identified for as to what species it is. Tuna may be one of the exceptions, but even there, we're talking about maybe 20 different variations on the theme of tuna, but they're all carnivores. They all have a big carbon footprint, all take hundreds of or thousands of pounds of plants out of the ecosystem to make even 1 pound of them.
Hmm. Well, Michael Pollan's advice, quite simply, is eat mostly plants.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And they're good for you. They're good for you. I can't tell you how many books and lectures I've attended and tried to absorb that talk about human health and how this country, the United States, consumes such an unhealthy diet overall, and it's a key to obesity as well. Jamie Oliver, who just got the TED Prize this year, has really dedicated himself to trying to educate the world about better choices. And it doesn't have to be a pain to eat vegetables. They can be some of the most delicious and delightful and good for you sources of food imaginable, especially when you grow them yourself or get them locally while they're still really fresh. But there are many options out there. Part of the reason for our success as a species is that we are omnivores. We get by on many choices. When you look at many of the other creatures on the planet, they have very few choices. Seals and sea lions and dolphins and such, they eat fish because that's the only choice they've got. And as a consequence, they are getting loaded with the things that are really bad for their health. High levels of mercury, high levels of pesticides. And it's not, we're seeing declines in some populations because of what they naturally eat that's contaminated by what we're putting into our living world. Mm.
Oceanographer Sylvia Earle is our guest this afternoon. She's National Geographic Explorer in Residence. She is the author of The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or an email message, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk with some listeners now. First, we're going to go to Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I, too, am concerned about the overfishing of the oceans, but I also am concerned that we not just sort of blindly go into industrial confinement raising of aquaculture as well, because you use the example of chickens and hogs that are raised more quickly, but you know, in doing that, they're not raising very healthy animals, and they are using a high degree of antibiotics and other drugs, which have, you know, effects that go far beyond the effects they have on those animals. And I've heard that there are problems, for instance, with the domestic raising of salmon that have caused pathogens to be leached into the passing populations of wild salmon that have led to, you know, damaging their populations greatly, so that, you know, we even have even fewer wild salmon. And I'm sure there are a lot of other potential problems that with the domestication of aquaculture that we need to consider, and I hope that you're taking that in, you know, into your consideration when you promote this and are been looking at that.
Absolutely. I really am not a fan of raising salmon in any case, because they are carnivores. You have to go out and catch, or at least what they're doing presently is catching a lot of wild fish to get a few farm fish, and all those problems you've talked about are real. Smart aquaculture means that you recognize what the problems are, and then you do things differently. Closed systems, whereas they say in aquacultural circles, you get more crop per drop, but you pay close attention to the quality of the water. And in closed systems that are linked to extracting the nitrates and phosphates that tend to build up in any closed system by planting crops such as hydroponic lettuce or tomatoes or other edible crops that can extract those and need the nitrates and phosphates. I've seen like a big figure eight, several setups in Australia and out at the Island School in the Bahamas, where they are successfully raising tilapia. And the water is clear. They don't use antibiotics. The food comes from the plants that are readily available, much lower carbon footprint than eating or even grazing animals. There's some concern about the big footprint on the land and the big water print, too, of raising cattle. The thing is, there are now close to 7 billion of us, and it would be great if we could have a smaller number of people and a healthier planet overall to sustain us. And one way or the other, we'll probably have to face up to that, because already we are consuming so much of the water, of the calories that are produced by plants naturally and those that we cultivate. There are limits to how much this planet can accommodate. But while we solve and address those problems, having high-quality protein, and, of course, plant protein is maybe the very best we should be aiming for, but low on the food chain for cultivating animals, and that means salmon doesn't qualify. They're high on the food chain. And I really favor the smallest possible footprint for an aquaculture setup with maintaining the quality of the water, but there are ways to do that without jamming up the system with antibiotics and other chemical treatments. It's part of the definition of smart aquaculture.
Mm. Does a listener want a quick follow-up?
Well, I just want to, I guess, make the point that the quality of life for the animals affects how nutritious and how healthy they are for us to consume, and that's been shown certainly with doing analysis of hogs and chicken and other animals. They're allowed to live in an environment that is non-stressful to them, and I want to make sure that if we're going to go into big way into industrial agriculture or aquaculture, that they're also not stressing the animals in that environment.
I agree.
Well,
they just passed that right along. Dan Barber, who's a notable chef, has really celebrated a kind of aquaculture that really it's working with nature, with marshes and plants and crops that are and allowing birds to thrive, and at the same time productive systems that enable us to extract some. It's not quite wild, but it's not this intensive agribusiness kind of cultivation of food that has turned out to be really, well, it provides a lot of calories. It isn't turning out to be really good for our health. About half the calories that we consume right now around the world come from just three grains, corn, rice, and wheat. And, of course, there are variations on the theme of those three categories, but that's where most of what it either takes to feed us or the animals that we consume come from literally about 100 plants out of the 250,000 plants, species of the flowering plants at least. And then there's another whole realm of possibility in the little guys. Already we raise yeast to as a food supplement that's very nutritious and can be grown in relatively small areas and highly controlled, so you don't get the bad things in them that you don't want in you. You get the good things, not the bad things. And there's a trend toward like the omega-3 plankton that is grown in small areas. There are other sources of microbial protein and the other fats and starches that are the basis of what keep us alive. No other creature on the planet has the capacity to really understand the source of food and make adjustments in ways that are beneficial to them. That's what gives us an edge. But right now, we're not using that edge. We're acting like Neanderthals going out there consuming wildlife from the sea using destructive means and not really thinking about tomorrow. At least that's been the case up until recently. I think now there are moves with protected areas in the ocean, marine protected areas that are restoring life, enabling fish a chance to reproduce and recover some of the depletion that we've imposed upon them. I think there's a lot of good news.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call, a listener on line 4 in Eureka, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask, and I'm very concerned about climate change and so many of the people that seem so skeptical and closed-minded toward it. What specific evidences are there of climate change that you can see from the ocean? And I'd like to follow up, too, please.
Sure. It's amazing that there continue to be skeptics or that there's a perception that scientists are in disagreement about it. It's one of the areas where there's, you know, like 97%+ accord among scientists, not just that we have a shifting, changing climate, but that humans are at the root cause of the accelerated change that we're experiencing. I know on the East Coast and throughout much of the country during the past week or so, people say, global warming? What global warming? They dig out of their snowbanks. But you have to look at the overall trends and put it in the context not just of one winter, but the decades and the centuries and even the millennia. And there's no question that since the end of, or the height of the last ice age some 15,000 years ago, the planet has been getting warmer. Sea level has been rising. There was another whole Florida out there as big as the one that's now above water going back some 15,000 years ago, and it happens periodically over ages. At one point, of course, not so long ago, geologically speaking, sea level was considerably higher, like 300 feet higher than it is today. Florida all but disappeared, for example, and much of the coastal wetlands that we now see were really wet. Goodbye, Louisiana. But what's happened in the last century, especially the last 50 years, and the pace has been accelerating in a way that is breathtaking. The changes are taking place coincident with an accelerating CO2 rise in the atmosphere. It isn't just CO2. It's also methane, other greenhouse gases, but you can look at that single gas that we need CO2 because it drives photosynthesis. And photosynthesis is important, obviously, to fix food, but it also generates oxygen. But too much CO2, more than the green plants on the land and in the sea can take up and incorporate into this important cycle of generating oxygen and fixing carbon, it's turning to carbonic acid. It's a measurable change in what's happening to the ocean from where it was on a steady basis for centuries, and so steady that many scientists basically almost didn't bother to measure the pH of the ocean because it was always the same. But then it did begin to change, and now measurements are being made around the world to try to monitor and track what's happening and the consequences of that to life in the ocean. Again, it's like the addition of pesticides and herbicides and other things. It's a change in the chemistry of the planet, of the ocean, and therefore our life support system. With the warming trend that we've witnessed in the last, well, particularly since the 1980s, has accelerated the coral bleaching phenomenon, where the plants that live in association with coral reef structures, the animals that make up the structure of coral reefs, those plants can't take the increase in temperature and they escape. And that leaves these amazingly colorful coral reefs looking stark white. They look like a snowbank. They look like Washington, D.C. last week. That they lose their colorful nature, and with it, their source of, well, their partners. We aren't totally sure of how that partnership works with the plants living in the tissues of the corals, but we do know that when the plants die or escape, for a while the corals can survive. Sometimes they can recover when the plants return to the tissues, but they're weakened. They don't reproduce during the years that they're bleached, and often it's just the first step toward an early death. Around the world, in half a century, half the coral reefs have disappeared or are in a state of sharp decline. That's a wake-up call. And the destruction of the fish and with it the fisheries, to have lost 90% of most of the big fish in the sea, that should be a wake-up call. So, I mean, there go on down the list of concerns. The trawled areas in the Gulf of Mexico, in the North Sea, off the coast of China, where once luxuriant, thriving ecosystems were maintaining the integrity of the planet, now they're just, they've been destroyed. Mm-hmm. It's like World War II after the war. You know, recovery can take place, but it's going to take a time.
Could I ask another question, please?
Go ahead quickly, though. We've got some other callers.
Okay, fine. Does it appear to you like the Arctic ice pack is melting faster than many scientists have predicted?
Absolutely. 2007, it just sort of dropped off the graph. And 2008, it kind of came back up a bit. But last year, 2009, it again was back at amazingly sharp levels. And it has shocked scientists who imagined that it could happen, but that was like a worst-case scenario. We are experiencing the worst-case scenario in terms of projections, so that having open water throughout the summer in the Arctic is likely to happen before the middle of this century.
Mm-hmm. Thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call, a listener on line one. Hold on, I'm getting a signal from Henry Freyna, our technical director, that I should hold on here. Well, in the meantime, tell you what let's do. I have a question about something else that we could do. We talked about seafood and the animals and plants in the ocean that we consume. I think another big problem that we have a role in definitely is all the garbage that we've put into the ocean. And I read recently that there are ecological consequences that we are not sure what they are, but they are out there from all the plastics that we've put into the ocean. Want to give us a minute on that?
Sure. Well, first, I have to say that I come from the pre-plasticozoic era. When I was a kid, we didn't have plastic bags and all of the things that have so affected our lives in mostly a positive way when you think about it. It's what we do with plastic when we're through with it, and we have somehow gotten into the habit of having one-time use or things that we use a few times and then throw it away, but there is no away. It's all coming back into the same little blue planet that is the only home we'll ever have. And it's a matter of perception, of awareness, that we just can't trash the planet, and yet we have, just through largely not knowing, through ignorance, through the belief that the ocean particularly is so vast that it can absorb whatever we put into it, but because we lose sight of it when things go into the sea, they seem to go away. That doesn't mean they are away. The great Pacific gyre off the coast of Hawaii is an accumulation of great mass of all the debris that we have allowed to flow in the sea. A lot of it is fishing gear that continues to fish and kill. We lose on the order of 300,000 dolphins, whales, sea lions, and other marine mammals every year because of entanglement in fishing gear. And that is simply unacceptable. And birds, we lose hundreds of thousands of long-lived albatrosses and other birds that get tangled up when they dive in to get what they think is something tasty, and it turns out to be plastic, and either they get tangled in fishing gear, or in the case of some of the seabirds, they swallow the plastic, take it back to their young, and stuff them with what seems like a something good to eat, and it turns out to be a deadly feast of plastic, and these fledgling birds never fly. Hundreds of thousands of them are dying. If we knew the consequences of just throwing away a plastic bag after one-time use or a cup or whatever, I think we'd change our ways.
Let's take another call now. This is a listener in Morris, Illinois. Line 2, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. You know, this is right up my alley, actually. Naturalist of the fishing in all forms, in all lakes, streams, and oceans are being depleted.
Part of the
problem is, it just seems to me people just don't care anymore. You build a subdivision, and you know you put 90 to 100, you know, houses in it, or maybe in 1,000 houses. Where does that water go in the runoff? All the salt and the debris that's in the gutters, it runs into the tributaries, right?
Well, Nemo, if you saw Finding Nemo, all drains lead to the sea.
Yeah, exactly. But part of the problem is we just don't care on our daily lives. You know, a lot of people recycle, but still that's not enough, because I can drive, you know, around the towns and cities around where you guys are at and find garbage by the truckloads on the side of the road. And I see it on a daily basis. Contractors, they have stuff blown out of the back of the truck. They got people that smoke, throw the cigarette, you know, butts out, and the wrappers to it out. I mean, I can go on and on.
Right.
The bottom line is, what's happening to our species, us? Sooner or later, it's coming back to us. We're going to run out of things. And we got nobody to blame but ourselves. But, you know, of course, we'll try to blame something else. But we're only good for blowing things up. That's the only thing we're good for, blowing things up and killing people.
Well,
that's
a really pessimistic view. I would rather think that maybe what we need to do is become more aware of what we're doing and think before we act. I don't know. Sylvia Earle, what's your opinion?
I am with you that, and also with the caller, you know, it is a little discouraging because we behave like, I don't know, savages in so many ways and take without thinking of the consequences. But the best hope is that we have the capacity to do better. But it does start with knowing. That is really the key. When I think about the creatures on the planet who can live as long as we do, turtles and albatrosses and orange roughy and whatever, may well realize that the world isn't the same place that they arrived at when they were youngsters. But they don't know why. And they don't know what to do about it. But we do know why. We can look around. We can see the world with better communication than we've ever had before. That's probably the best hope for us, that we now can see ourselves in contact, look at the world through the eyes of astronauts, and understand that it's not just about future generations, although that certainly counts. It's about us in our lifetime. We've seen the quality of the environment that keeps us alive deteriorate, even while many things have improved, like the new medicines, new communication, new technologies. But we not only know what's wrong, we have the capacity, unlike dolphins and whales and albatrosses, we can do something about it. We have the power. And I think the real power comes with the kids. And I hope in the kid that's lurking within all of us, the kid that says, you know, we can do this. They don't know that. They don't know defeat. When you're a kid, you can do anything. And I think we have to revive that spirit and realize that, yeah, we've got tons of problems, but it isn't too late, and we're not without power.
Yeah. Well, thanks to your prodding, the ocean is now in Google Earth.
Yeah.
That's a pretty neat thing.
It is. That's a new way of showing how the world works.
Tell us a little bit about that. I have only had a little bit of time to look around in there, but it is amazing.
It's dangerous. It's dangerous. You can lose yourself on Google Earth. I mean, I did before they put the ocean there. But if you went to Google Earth to look at your backyard or your neighbor's backyard or to fly the Grand Canyon or to find the hotel or whatever it is, if you could visit the North Pole or the South Pole, you could do that 2 years ago, but until this time last year, the ocean was pretty much missing. But thanks to John Hanke and the team of crafty engineers and 30 or so scientists that we put together to advise on how do you make the world complete, there now is much more to see when you fly around Google Earth. You can dive in. You can see what whales see. You can go off in many places that you can actually go and see what the terrain is like underwater, and that was not possible until about a year ago. So it's great because you can see the world with new eyes. You can certainly see that it's blue, but that the blue lives. That's really a gift.
Yeah. I have one last question. It's kind of a big one, and I can't give you very much time. I apologize for that. But, you know, here in the Midwest, there's a compact between the U.S. Great Lakes states and the Canadian Great Lakes provinces to protect the Great Lakes. There isn't anything similar for the ocean, is there?
It's coming. Nations are beginning to step up to the recognition that their economy depends on taking care of the oceans, as if their economies depend on it, because they do, or our health, or our security, or fundamentally our lives. There are moves by individual countries to protect their exclusive economic zone in ways comparable to protecting the land through national parks. It is only about less than 1% of the ocean that has that kind of protection, but as people are beginning to awaken to it, the idea that we need to protect the natural systems that keep us alive, because they keep us alive, because they drive our economies. I mean, Tim Wirth once said that the the economy as a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. I gave a talk at the World Bank a couple of years ago, and I put a picture of the Earth from space up there, and I said, there it is, the World Bank. We need to take care of the assets, but we've been drawing them down. And for you in the Midwest, the Great Lakes are tremendous assets. And to protect the bank that gives us those benefits is really the key to having those assets far into the future instead of burning through them in a generation or two.
Sylvia Earle, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. There is plenty of reason for hope, and I'm so glad to hear you express that, and thank you.
You're very welcome. What a pleasure to talk with you. Sylvia Earle is an oceanographer and National Geographic Explorer in Residence. She's a former NOAA chief scientist. She's been called her deepness, and Time magazine honored her as its first hero for the planet, while the Library of Congress has named her a living legend. Her book, The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One, is published by the National Geographic Society.